Ladies and gentlemen, could you take a seat, please? If I had some gladioli, I'd be a bit like Barry Humphries at this stage. Do come in and find a seat. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's presentation. My name's Mike McKellar. I'm the president of the AIIA Victoria, and it's terrific to see such a good gathering here today, but particularly to see so many younger members of society coming along and taking part in this exercise. What we're going to learn about today is the world of terrorism 10 years after 9/11. And there's been a few changes to the program, but that'll be explained as we go along. What have we learnt? Where are we at? All those sorts of issues that relate to global terrorism as it is being experienced in various parts of the world. Our first speaker tonight is Mr. Shandon Harris-Hogan, who's a doctoral candidate at the Global Terrorism Research Centre at Monash. He's standing in for Pete Lentini, who unfortunately couldn't be here with us tonight. I'm told by his supervisors that he's an outstanding doctoral candidate, and he's going to give us a generic post-2001 overview, how it evolved, and what we have learned from it to this stage. He will then be followed by Dr. Doyle, who will then be followed by Dr. Barton. Unfortunately, Mr. Chris Helfinger can't be with us tonight from the United States, but that'll be explained a little bit later on this evening. So the evening will take the form of 3 10-minute addresses, followed by questions and discussions, and we don't want to hold up discussions at all. I've been assured that that's just what the academics really like to know about, to get the feeling for what the people in the general populace are anxious to know more about, and so that will be available for people, those questions and discussion time will be available after the conclusion of the official presentations. Now, Dr.-elect Shandon, please come in. Would you please welcome Shandon Harris-Hogan to talk to us for 10 minutes on global terrorism from the Global Terrorism Research Centre at Monash. He's going to give us this generic post-2001 overview.
Thank you very much for your very generous I'm not quite sure I'm deserving of all of that, but very nice introduction, I've got to say. I'm a member of the Monash University's Global Terrorism Research Centre. I work as a researcher, countering violent extremism, and I work on a project aimed at understanding the radicalisation process and the de-radicalisation process with particularly Australian terrorists. Now, just before I start talking specifically, it's important to recognise that we have violence of all kinds in Australia, and we have extremists of various types, whether they be environmental extremists, Tamil Tigers, Christian fundamentalists, right-wing people. But also within Australia, we have a very, very small section of society that are actually prepared to use violence. Now, I'm going to be focusing on the neo-jihadist phenomenon post-9/11 and its impact on Australia, but that follows the same kind of theme. It's a very, very, very small network of people that are actually prepared to engage in any type of violence. Now, when I say neo-jihadists, what I'm talking about here is something that's simultaneously a religious, political, paramilitary and a terrorist global movement. It's a subculture, it's a counterculture, and it's more than anything, it's an ideology that seeks to establish states governed by laws according to the dictates of very selectively literal interpretations of the Quran and the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, normally through enacting violence. Now, attacks against Australians, Australian interests, and on Australian soil are not a new phenomenon. However, the potential severity of these attacks has increased in the last two decades, as globalisation and advances in modern technology have augmented Australia's relationships with the rest of the world. Now, this is especially so in the case of Islamic extremist groups and those who they inspire. Australia's 1997 Foreign and Trade Policy White Paper, titled In the National Interest, did not even list terrorism among a number of potential non-military threats to Australia. And at the turn of the century, Australia's peak intelligence agency, the Office of National Assessments, did not employ a single analyst dedicated full-time to the threat of terrorism. However, the events of September 11, 2001, and slightly more relevant to us, the events, the Bali bombings a year later, made it abundantly clear that Australia's geostrategic isolation was not a significant enough barrier to shield Australia from the rising tide of Islamic militancy around the world. Now, between 2001 and 2003, Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and his deputy, Ayman Zawahiri, made six separate statements citing Australia as a potential target due to its military involvements in East Timor, Iraq and Afghanistan. Additionally, over 200 Australian civilians have been killed in attacks by neo-jihadists since 2001, and the Australian embassies in Jakarta, Iraq and Phnom Penh have all been targeted. Sorry, if you'll have to bear with me, I'm reasonably technologically illiterate. There we go. Now, what we see in Australia is that the first plots were largely directed from overseas. Now, if we move chronologically, we'll begin looking at persons connected to Australia's maiden experience of neo-jihadi activity, the Jamaa Islamiyah-directed Mantiqi 4. Now, Mantiqi 4 is the branch of Jamaa Islamiyah, which operated in Australia, from the early 90s until the 2002 Bali bombings. And their membership comprised the first neo-jihadists in Australia. Now, the direction of the Mantiqi 4 cell was almost entirely given from overseas. Although a Malaysian man was specifically dispatched by senior JI figure Hambali to train and discipline Mantiqi 4, and they conducted at least one training camp in Australia, in the Blue Mountains, in 1999, by memory, the group remained largely underdeveloped. For many years, Mantiqi 4 largely acted as a kind of fundraising arm for the other three wings of JI. However, in 2000, on request from Hambali, it became what you might loosely call an operational cell when Jack Roche was sent for overseas training. He was instructed to recruit two white Australian Muslims who were to go to Afghanistan for training, to be trained one in explosives and the other in sniping. And when he returned to Australia, he also conducted surveillance on potential targets, including the Israeli embassy and prominent Australian Jewish figures. However, Roach, upon his return, kind of got a case of cold feet and actually called ASIO in July 2000 to confess his involvement in this plot. And the plan was officially aborted by Abu Bakr Bashir on the request of a prominent Australian sheikh in August 2000. So that's our initial sort of foray into Islamic militancy in Australia. The next plot was was coordinated largely by Lashkar-e-Toiba. It's up there. It represented what you could probably call the greatest threat to Australia ever posed by terrorism, particularly neo-jihadist terrorism. The architect of this plot is a senior LET commander, and he's the same man that also directed the 2008 attacks in Mumbai. He not only funded the operation, but he also kept in constant contact with important members of the cell throughout the training process. Well, he directed the plot, and a Pakistani-Australian facilitated the group's activities and was essential to the group's development and coordination. He recruited members into the cell and arranged for their travel to and from Pakistan in order to train. He was also the contact for another Frenchman upon his arrival in Australia. He held a senior role in GSPC. The group's name loosely translates to the Salafist group to call and combat. Together they sourced bomb-making materials and collected details of energy supply systems, energy infrastructure, and examined satellite images of transportation systems around Sydney. However, following a tip to ASIO by DST in France, concerning the Frenchmen that arrived here, police began investigating their activities. The Frenchman was subsequently deported, and subsequently the leader of the cell was witnessed dropping an envelope into a rubbish bin at a local reserve, which is all quite kind of cloak and dagger spy novel type of activity. They arrested him at this point, and that was kind of the end of the plot. Inside the envelope were aerial photos of targets, including Victoria Barracks and Her Majesty's Australian ship Penguin. Now, a more recent statement by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade regarding the contemporary threat posed to Australia by what I've called neo-jihadists, warns that the country is now directly threatened by a kind of terrorism that is not only transnational in nature, but is now more dangerous than previous examples of terrorism. Similarly, a former director of Australia's Office of National Assessments, our peak intelligence agency, stated that the greatest terrorist threat now comes from a large, diverse and fluid network of Islamist groups and individuals, more often inspired by Al-Qaeda and directed by it. It's essentially now become more of a homegrown phenomenon rather than something that's directed from overseas. And we have three separate homegrown self-starting cells which have been recently uncovered on the east coast of Australia, or more recently uncovered on the east coast of Australia. Additionally, internet material contributed to the radicalisation of another lone wolf Australian neo-jihadist who threatened revenge attacks against ASIO and DFAT following the refusal of a visa application. But of a more serious nature, on Tuesday the 8th of November 2005, raids were conducted in the largest joint terrorism operation in Australian history. As a result, cells were discovered in Victoria and New South Wales. They had been under surveillance by ASIO, federal and state police for 16 months. Called Operation Pendennis, it ran from July 2004 until 2005 and accumulated 16,500 hours of recordings from bugs and 98,000 telephone intercepts. Now, there were cells in both Victoria and New South Wales, but the Sydney cell appears to have represented the more advanced threat. Members of the cells were using false names to obtain chemical ingredients for bomb making and bomb making manuals and literature of this type was discovered on the computer of several of the arrested members. In regards to a potential target, three Sydney members were stopped by police while scouting Lucas Heights nuclear reactor. They'd cut a padlock to enter the sort of a couple of K exclusion zone around the outside of the reactor. And it's suspected that the men were assessing the feasibility of firing rocket launchers into the reactor itself. According to a police statement, the leader of the group actually said, "I'm going to blow up the nuclear place." Now, the Melbourne cell, which consisted of 15 individuals, 9 ultimately convicted on terrorism charges, and an additional undercover Victoria police officer, which was referred to as SIA-39. Now, the group in Melbourne, it's subsequently been revealed, intended to carry out an attack on the MCG during the September 2005 AFL Grand Final. But the plan was postponed because of security reasons, but more practically, funding difficulties that the group had. Future potential targets were discussed by the group, which may have included the Crown Casino on Grand Prix weekend, but it was largely speculation, and by this stage, the police had their cell well and truly under surveillance. But in the words of the group's leader, the goal of that particular cell was to, quote, die as martyrs or win and get an Islamic State. That's all we want. Now, the most recent thwarted attack, and the last one I'm going to mention, was in 2009 under Operation Neath. Neath was a joint federal police, Victoria Police and ASIO investigation, which began in January 2009 and culminated in 5 arrests in July 2009. Now, in midway through this period, CCTV footage witnessed the group's central figure conducting surveillance at Holsworthy Army Barracks in Western Sydney, and another member of the cell had also left for Somalia to train with Al-Shabaab. He was also seeking a fatwa, a religious ruling to justify potential attacks on Australian soil. The men ultimately planned to obtain weaponry and launch a suicide mission on Holsworthy Army Barracks because of what they saw were injustices relating to Muslims both in Australia and in Afghanistan and Iraq. So over this 10-year period, a number of Australians have been arrested for terrorism-related activity in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Somalia and Yemen, as well as Australia. Now, what is remarkable about this group of Australian new jihadists is that the publicly identified network is quite small. Now, using a reasonable definition of serious involvement, this Australian network of neo-jihadists contains between 80 and maximum 100 known, publicly known individuals. Of particular interest is that of all known Australian neo-jihadists, Sydney and Melbourne account for over 90% of the entire network. Now, through a combination of government and law enforcement, and at times the sheer incompetence of the individuals involved, we're yet to see anything really close to a successful terrorist attack on Australian soil. But as mentioned, since 9/11, there has been a consistent threat. In fact, if you track it back, it's occurred once every 2 years or so. You had the JI threat in 2000-2001 with Jack Roach, the LET director plot in 2003. Then you see a shift, and it was a fairly organic shift. This wasn't directed by anybody. It was just the movement naturally evolving. And in 2005, you see men arrested in Sydney and Melbourne. They're Australians. The plot is hatched, directed, everything from in Australia. In 2007, nearly half a dozen Australians are arrested in Lebanon doing something in Lebanon. And in 2009, you've got 5 men arrested in Melbourne. So going by that theory of something every 2 years, being 2011, 10 years on from 9/11, we're about due. Now, the nature of these type of movements is that they're very, very, very hard to predict, and nobody saw the evolution of the last cell. We can have ideas, but yeah, we need to be constantly vigilant because something may develop into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Shandon. Now, so hold your questions at this stage, write them down, because there's going to be a lot of information provided for you, and we want to be reminded of it when the time comes for questions. Our second speaker is Dr. Natalie Doyle, who is the Deputy Director of the Monash European and EU Studies Centre. She recently organised a conference entitled Globalisation, Illiberalism, the West and Islam: European and Australian Perspectives. And she did it in a marvellous place. She did it on the Monash University's Prato campus in Italy, which I'm told is just near Venice, which is a nice place to organise a conference, I would have thought. Would you please welcome the Deputy Director of the Monash European and EU Study Centre, Dr. Natalie Doyle.
Thank you very much for your welcome. And yes, Prato is a wonderful place to have a conference and to be very, very productive. But to sort of connect to Shandon's presentation, I mean, Shandon's presentation has demonstrated that research, terrorist activity in Australia has had international connections to many different regions of the globe, but to Europe as well. I think, I'm not sure I have the recognition, but I think you did mention the case of Willy Brigitte, that French convert to radicalized form of Islam who was here, I think, in 2005. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm not an expert on terrorism, so I'm going to look at this whole issue from a slightly different angle, right? And I'm going to be maybe a little bit mysterious at first, but that should trigger your interest, I think. Now, if you follow the news closely, and I'm sure you do, you would know that the most recent case of terrorism that took place in Europe was in the very wealthy and peaceful country of Norway. When the news came out that there had been a major terrorist attack in Norway, and there was incredible speculation in Europe, in the West, in Australia, as to why Norway had been targeted by jihadists, right? What had happened in Norway to trigger anger on the part of international terrorist networks. Now, these interrogations soon revealed themselves to be totally irrelevant, because the perpetrator turned out to be the blonde and blue-eyed Anders Behring Breivik. And I just realized I forgot to bring you a picture. I brought you other pictures, but I forgot to bring a picture of Breivik. And this terrorist just did not fit into all our imaginary representations of who the terrorists are, what the typical terrorist is, because he was not a Muslim. he corresponded so little to the image that we have of terrorism today that the Australian private intelligence group site did not know what to do with him on their website. They had to publish something on a Norwegian attack, and would you believe it ended up in a section on their website entitled Jihadist News, because they didn't know what to do with it. And this brings me to the question of the influence which American counterterrorism has had on European perceptions of terrorism. An inquiry into American counterintelligence, which has been conducted over the last 2 years by the Washington Post, which is called Top Secret America, has shown that an incredibly complex network of agencies, both public and private, has been created. And it is a network which is largely unaccountable and not really scrutinized in the public sphere. And this network has prevented the United States from developing, some argue, and certainly the Washington Post does, the right strategy to eliminate the threat of terrorism. Now, another American institution has been delving into this issue in greater depth. This is the Center for American Progress, which is a public policy research and advocacy organization. It has just produced a report which was published in August, and which I discovered thanks to Greg, which is called Fear Incorporated. And this report shows that a number of private agencies which are part of this network have had a disproportionate influence on public perceptions of terrorism in the United States, but as I will show also in Europe. They have been promoting this view that terrorism is essentially an Islamic phenomenon, and they have actively contributed to the rise of Islamophobia in the United States, and this is how I'm going to come to Europe finally. I would argue that this post-September 11 American Islamophobia has grafted itself in Europe on a pre-existing form of Islamophobia, which has its distant roots in Serbian propaganda, propaganda which flourished at the time of the Kosovo War. It was Serbian activists who were the first to speak of the threat of an Islamization of Europe and to assimilate Islam with political totalitarianism by coining this expression Islamofascism, an expression which one still encounters in public debates in countries such as France. Now, European Islamophobia, I believe, and this was discussed in the conference organized in Prato, has been gathering strength over the last 10 years, and it seems to have become particularly acute since the global financial crisis. And it may well be, in fact, aggravating the danger of terrorist attacks taking place in Europe in two different ways. First of all, it has encouraged suspicion and in some cases outright hostility towards the Muslim minorities which are now residing in a number of European countries. There is plenty of evidence that Muslims residing in Europe are subject to a range of discriminations, which is encouraging a sense of victimization. And this sense of victimization obviously is not the sole cause of terrorism. It's one of the factors that feeds into terrorism. But certainly it is fertile ground for the ideology of jihadism promoted by international terrorist networks to recruit new foot soldiers, meaning suicide bombers. Now, there is another way in which this new form of Islamophobia is perhaps, in fact, unwittingly promoting terrorist violence. The growth of European Islamophobia has also produced a new form of right-wing extremism in Europe, which has just produced in Norway the first case of what is known as lone wolf terrorism. Breivik was a lone wolf terrorist. This expression is tied to the kind of terrorism which the United States have known and for a long time was thought to be a primarily American problem linked to white supremacist ideas. But the beliefs and actions of Breivik fit perfectly into the pattern of lone wolf terrorism. Now, these two new forms of terrorism, one much more recent, that European lone wolf terrorism, one that we've known for 10 years and more, jihadist terrorism, are on opposing sides, but in fact they occupy the same imaginary space. What is this imaginary space? It is the belief that some kind of cosmic war between good and evil is now being waged in the world, and that this is being concealed by public institutions. And so This ideology suggests that violent action is needed to alert people to what is really going on. That's what both jihadists and Breivik were saying, right? They had to wake up everybody to the real struggle that was taking place on a planetary scale. Now, for jihadists, this war between good and evil opposes the ideal, pure community of Muslims, the Ummah, which in fact does not exist, which is purely visual, which exists in their imagination, and the West. For the extreme right-wing terrorists, for the European extreme right-wing terrorists like Anders Behring Breivik, evil threatens the Christian identity of Europe, and it has taken the form of mass Muslim immigration. Now, this idea of a Muslim invasion of Europe was first presented most forcefully in a book which Breivik repeatedly quotes in a manifesto he published on the internet. And this book is called Eurabia, the Euro-Arab Axis. And I've just put you a photo there. And it was published in 2004-5 by Batya O. This is, in fact, a pen name for a Jewish Egyptian-born British writer. And this book is very controversial, but in a sense, and I don't think this is an exaggeration to say this, it transposes onto Islam a conspiratorial myth, the same myth which underpinned anti-Semitism at the end of the 19th century, you know, the famous protocol of the wise men of Sinai. The new version of this old myth involves a deal, presumably made by European state leaders with Arab countries. That's what has been arguing happened. A deal between European countries and Arab countries under French leadership in exchange for petrol and for protection from terrorism, so cooperation on the terrorism front, European countries would accept mass immigration from the Middle East. And according to the new right-wing extremist thinking, this immigration is now destroying European culture. Now, the idea that Europe is threatened by a new kind of Muslim invasion has become the theme of predilection for a new form of extreme right-wing ideology, of which the Dutchman Geert Wilders is the iconic figure. And I don't have the pointer, but you know his face. I'm sure you would recognize him there up there. And I will suggest, and this is something that I certainly explored and was discussed as well in the conference that we had in Prato, the European extreme right has undergone a kind of mutation, which has given it a kind of respectability, of a near respectability. It has abandoned the discourse of race and linked the notion of European identity, which it still defines primarily as Christian, to the liberal values of contemporary democracy, such as gender equality or gay rights. And Geert Wilders and the Freedom Party that he founded in the Netherlands are constantly advocating these principles. You know, gay rights are in fact being denied by Muslims, or gender equality is being denied by Muslims. So this extreme right-wing ideology is pushing the idea that Islam as a religion is by definition incompatible with these liberal values which define contemporary European culture and by extension Western culture. And this is a little cartoon representation of Geert Wilders here with his finger in the dam, right, trying to defend Western civilization from the flood of Muslim immigration. It's interesting to note, and obviously I can't go into the details, the similarities that exist between this new extremist ideology and the old-style Cold War anti-communist rhetoric. And Breivik's manifesto itself refers to what he calls an Islamo-Marxist conspiracy. And according to him, this Islamo-Marxist conspiracy has seen multicultural relativism embraced by European governments and imposed on European societies. And the European Union, because I have to mention the European Union, because after all, I am the director of the Marat European EU Center, whose director is here. The European Union has been singled out as the big bogeyman, the force behind this multicultural relativism, which is destroying Christian European identity. Now, in Europe, and this is, I suppose, my main point, this extremist discourse has made inroads into mainstream public debates. and even mainstream politics. This, I believe, has been facilitated by the crisis of sovereign debt, which is now affecting an increasing number of European countries, a subplot being the very technical crisis of the euro, and I'm glad I don't have to talk about it now. It's clear that beleaguered political leaders, from David Cameron to Nicolas Sarkozy in France or Angela Merkel in Germany, have themselves made comments about multiculturalism being a problem, huh? Comments which clearly echo Breivik's rhetoric. So, to lead to my conclusion, because I obviously want to keep the time that was allotted to me, I think what is happening in Europe is a kind of crisis of democracy. Democracy is being undermined by a new form of populist politics, which promotes the idea that the central problem of our era of globalization is the issue of cultural identity, and that this is somewhat essentially and exclusively linked to the presence of Muslims in Western societies. This, in a sense, has perverted the notion of democratic citizenship because quite a number of those Muslims in Europe are actually citizens, right, of European nation states. It is a perversion of democratic citizenship which seeks to include a category of people simply on the basis of their religion. And, well, the question is it maybe now also threatening Australia as well? And I'll just give one example. The question of Muslim female dress, which did not seem to bother anybody just 2 years ago, I think, in Australia. Nobody ever talked about it. Right? The question of the headscarf, then the full body veil or burqa. This question has in fact been agitating European politicians for the past 10 years. Huh? And last year, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it was 2 years ago, because I don't follow Australian politics or Australian social issues that closely, but about a year ago, it seems to me, it also became the subject of public debates here in Australia. It also seems to have inspired strange social phenomena. I don't know if you remember, there was a little item about a year ago about somebody having painted black burqas on the Russian dolls that sit there outside those commission flats there in Fitzroy. I have no idea. I think we still don't know what they meant, right? But obviously the burqa and the black burqa suddenly seem to enter, you know, the imagination of Victorians and Melbournians, right? Now, this question of female dress in Europe, right, has been at the centre of a raft of new legislative measures across different European countries, which are highly questionable from a human rights point of view. And I listen to human rights lawyers on this question because I'm not an expert. Now, the question obviously is of knowing whether Australia could also go down that path. The campaign waged by Cory Bernardi, the South Australian senator, certainly points that way. And the fact that he has invited Geert Wilders, right, is a little bit troubling, right? So I suppose to connect back to what Shandon was talking about, right, obviously terrorism, jihadist terrorism, is a real threat, right? There's no denying it. And Australia has up to this point been very successful in countering this threat of international Islamic terrorism without endangering social cohesion, without endangering peaceful coexistence between the various communities that form part of Australian society. But I suppose I will end on a question. Maybe some lessons from the past 10 years still need to be drawn, right, in Australia, in Europe, in the United States, in the Western world as a whole, and that will serve as a kind of transition, I think, to the presentation which my colleague Greg Barton will be making. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Doyle. I noted amongst the words you used tonight, you said that you had a bit of trouble following Australian politics. I'll tell you what, you're not the only one at the present time. Our final speaker tonight is Professor Greg Barton, who, of course, is well known to us. He is the director of the Centre for Islam and the Modern World at Monash University. He and Dr. Lentini are conducting a research project to examine radicalisation in Australia and around the world. And this, I think, is most interesting. It involves a partnership of Monash University, the Victoria Police, the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet, Corrections Victoria, and the Australian Federal Police. So it really is covering a multitude of organisations there in conducting this research. And I'm sure that you, like me, will be very interested to hear what Dr. Barton has to say to us tonight. Would you please welcome Greg Barton?
Right, thank you very much. I think it's good for us to move fairly quickly on to question and answer discussion. So I'll present a very, very simple overview of my attempt at stocktaking where we've got to in the last 10 years, because 9/11 was not the beginning of international terrorism. It was hardly the start, but it was in the Western Hemisphere, particularly in the English-speaking world, something that came as a tremendous shock. For most events we could imagine in the past, a headline or a front page like this front page from September 12, 2001 in the New York Times would have been as shocking as one could imagine. But the truly shocking thing about the 9/11 attack was that by the time you picked up your copy of the New York Times on the 12th of September, you didn't need to know any more details. I mean, you read it because you wanted to find some analysis, but you'd probably watched it, if not with your own eyes, on the streets of Manhattan. Certainly, I think for many, many millions of people, hundreds of millions of people by most accounts, watched it via satellite television in real time. So you saw perhaps not the first aircraft go in, of course, but you likely saw the second, and you likely saw the towers collapse, and you saw footage from the Pentagon. That's really terribly shocking, and so it sort of it marked a sense of a moment in history when things start. You know, for a long time before that, people would say the question about history was, where were you when Kennedy was shot? Well, I won't tell you where I was, but not in a capacity to report on it. But in more recent times, this was one of those turning points in history. There had long been a problem with terrorism. Europe had long faced a problem with terrorism. Countries like India and Pakistan had long had problems, but in a sense the West suddenly paid attention on this date. And so it posed this question, or this statement, that this changes everything. Now, that was always going to be a bit of hyperbole. It was never going to be a literal, factual statement. But in a sense, it still is one of those statements that begs the question, how much has changed? I mean, we know it literally didn't change everything. Nothing changes everything. But it certainly sparked hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in counterterrorism, and it's seen a lot of good things come out of it, a lot of important work, but it's a very incomplete response. If we look at the question of the domestic domain, if we ask ourselves in Australia where we're at, Shandon's outlined what the major incidents we've faced, and I'd have to say in terms of community response, engagement with communities, in terms of the development of police and intelligence capacity, we're travelling pretty well. There's every reason to say that Australia, you know, you're never immune from these kind of attacks, but we're as safe and doing as well as one could imagine. The same is largely true for America. You could question some of the police interceptions. There's been an element of sting operations in some of the interceptions, but basically the intelligence work has been outstanding. The reason there's been no further attacks is not for lack of trying. It's because the agencies are finally getting together and cooperating. You'd hardly say the Department of Homeland Security is an elegant piece of harmonious cooperation, but things are working reasonably well. The same is true of Europe, notwithstanding the attacks that Europe has witnessed in London and in Madrid. The story in the rest of the world is more mixed. In Southeast Asia, Indonesia has surprised us with its response. The Malaysian authorities haven't had the same threat of an immediate attack. There's reasons why attacks don't occur in Malaysia, but they're putting a lot of resources into being alert to the threats. The Philippines and Thailand are very different stories. This is where the story begins to change. The Philippines hasn't made a lot of progress despite an awful lot of investment. Thailand has exacerbated its own problem in the south. The problem in the south of Thailand is not an international terrorist problem per se to begin with, but they've made it increasingly that way. And if there's not some shift of policy, that's what it'll end up becoming. In South Asia, the situation is just very much worse than we really understand. It's significant that yesterday's bombing in New Delhi outside the High Court, of course attracted media attention, but it's not a story we're talking about endlessly today, because there's been so many bombings. There was a bombing in Mumbai in July, we think the same group. India, in fact, by international sort of measures, is terror central after Iraq and Afghanistan and Colombia. You sort of come, I think, number six on most counts to India. Hundreds of small attacks, many dozens of large attacks. The situation in Pakistan is very dire. That brings us to the question of the international domain. There are no root causes of international terrorism, but there certainly are enabling factors, and there are certainly circumstances that encourage the growth of terrorism. The threat that we're most conscious of is the threat posed by Salafi jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda, and that threat was born in Afghanistan. It was born initially with us, let's just say the West, encouraging a response to Soviet occupation, military occupation. So it was born through our active involvement. I'm not saying that was a mistake, but that was part of the story. What was a mistake, though, was our neglect of Afghanistan in the 1990s. So we engaged actively in the 1980s. We neglected Pakistan, Afghanistan in the 1990s, and only walked back to it in 2001 after 9/11, realizing we had to return to the source of the problem. But Afghanistan is very much tied up with Pakistan, and in American security circles, they talk about the AFPAC problem. Although most of the public discussion is about Afghanistan for political reasons, but they're just as concerned about the Taliban in Pakistan as they are in Afghanistan. The big issue here, I'll come back to Iraq and Afghanistan in a minute, we have other concerns in Yemen and Somalia, but the big issue is that we recognise that Afghanistan was a key part of the origin of this story. We responded, I think, appropriately by going into Afghanistan and going after Al-Qaeda. And then, you know the story, it was decided to invade Iraq because it was felt that there was a threat there. And you can construe a threat, it's true. But in terms of priorities, you've got to question the decision-making. This graph, I think, speaks to one of the problems of that decision. The purple line refers to troop numbers in Iraq, and the line at the bottom, the yellow line, refers to troop numbers in Afghanistan. And you can see it was not until the end of last year that those lines intersected. For a long time, the maximum effort was made in Iraq, where we didn't have a problem with terrorism until we got there, and a minimal effort was made in Afghanistan. I'm not saying that these are easy decisions or that war is a good thing, but I think the consensus about Afghanistan is that it's balanced on a knife edge. We don't know whether we'll succeed in establishing order in Afghanistan, but most analysts would say had we put more resources in at the beginning, we'd be in a much better position now. And it's only perhaps the last two or three years that we've been doing mostly the right thing in Afghanistan. And a large part of the reason for that distraction is what we were doing in Iraq. I'll slide through this very quickly, but I thought this image I saw yesterday in the Huffington Post is interesting because it's a photograph from the International Space Station. It's not photoshopped. That orange line is a line that was visible from space. That orange line is indeed the Pakistan-India border. And what you're seeing with that orange line is the sort of no man's zone that's obviously brightly lit with orange flood lighting for the length of the border. They used to say that you could only see very few man-made objects from space. One of them was the Great Wall of China. Well, now we've got another Great Wall visible. Of course, the sad irony is this Great Wall doesn't keep the problem out, just as the Great Wall in China didn't keep the problem out. We take stock of where we're going with Al-Qaeda. I think the general consensus is that Al-Qaeda, as we knew it, the central organisation, has been greatly, greatly weakened. And there's no question that the Bin Laden raid was an important important chapter of that weakening of Al-Qaeda. But the real threat from Al-Qaeda is posed from two fronts. One is Al-Qaeda affiliates like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, particularly in Yemen, the Islamic Jihad in Yemen, and from Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is the bigger threat. And, of course, that's not even going into the non-Al-Qaeda affiliates that nevertheless have been inspired or have worked with Al-Qaeda, groups like Jamaat Islamiyah, or whatever you want to call that loose network today in Southeast Asia. The second threat, though, for Al-Qaeda is that regardless of what happens to the organisation, regardless of the fact that its leader, Bin Laden, is no longer around, if you sort of give him due credit, and one doesn't want to do so, but if you sort of recognise what it is that he managed to achieve in his malicious intent, it was establishing of an extremist narrative. Shandon used the expression that my colleague Pete Lentini invented, neo-jihadism, because the original writers in the late 20th century on jihad, like Abdullah Azzam, spoke of a very limited engagement. What Al-Qaeda under bin Laden and others did was to remove the limits and say that we're at war, anything goes. This kind of extremism is a combination of Saudi Salafism, of the ideas of the Muslim Brotherhood, of the ideas that came from the Deoband school in India but were particularly popular in Pakistan through the Taliban and through contemporary militia like LET and the group behind yesterday's attacks, Huji. But it's neither Saudi Salafism by itself or the Muslim Brotherhood by itself. It's what came out of the crucible of Afghanistan that created something new, that sort of made a more extreme version of those ideas. So it's often referred to as Salafi jihadism, and of course it's not the only extremist narrative out there. I won't dwell on this because I want to move on to questions, but Natalie has talked about one other narrative that's at foot. I don't know if you know Pamela Geller and her website Atlas Shrugs. I wanted to find the page where she announced after the Norway attack that it was the work of jihadi extremists and Muslims, but she's taken that page down. this is a page from earlier this year where she talked about the threat of Muslims in Norway and their endemic involvement in epidemic involvement in rape and crime and violent assaults. If you don't take my word for my judgment of Pamela Geller, I'll suggest you have a look at her site, because this is really extreme rhetoric. What's interesting, though, is that the report that was mentioned earlier by the Center for American Progress, Fear Inc., which is a very reasonable and grounded report, goes through Breivik's manifesto and cites the number of references to people like Geller. And in Geller's case, there are, I think, several dozen references to her website. There's a curious kind of transatlantic borrowing of ideas. I'm going to move to questions, so let me just finish on one final point in terms of stock taking. If we ask where we're at, what we're doing, in Australia at least, I think we can be reasonably positive about where we've come, but the big challenge that faces us, something that we have done intuitively and are doing more consciously now, is something which is, I mean, every good thing gets a horrible acronym. That's just the way that politics, modern life, bureaucracy works. The acronym in this case is CEV, Countering Violent Extremism. I know it's not an elegant term, but if you hear this term, what it's referring to is the idea of getting to problems before there are problems. The Pendennis case and the Neath case cost tens of millions of dollars in terms of police operations and subsequent legal actions. They're the sort of things you don't ever want to do unless you have no choice. But you don't have a choice if people are planning something. You do have to intervene, you have to monitor, you have to prosecute. The idea of countering violent extremism is to get to people at risk before they get to the point of doing something criminal and try and deflect them in a different course. I'll leave those comments there, but this is something that Australia has been leading the way in. I don't want to say that we should slap ourselves on the back, but this is something that has been working. It's something that America is only very slowly coming around to. President Obama gave a speech the other day in which he spoke about this, and it's sort of very early baby steps in America. The UK, they've been doing a lot of this work, and this is the decade that lies ahead of us, and the decades to come, I think will focus particularly on this question of countering violent extremism. But I think it's probably time that we get into a discussion, so I'll hand it back to you.
Well, there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Who would like to ask the first question? Michael?
Dr. Bart, I think you touched on it when you said that the expression "will change the world," which I think is from my 10 years on, was probably hyperbole, but maybe it wasn't. Could you say to what extent? I mean, could you put a measure on the extent to which it's changed the world, and to which the extent to which that expression has turned out to be hyperbole?
Might be an amorphous question.
Yeah, look, it depends whose world. In terms of the Western Hemisphere, it's resulted in probably, depending how you count it, hundreds of billions of dollars of expenditure. If you take in Iraq and Afghanistan, according to many calculations, it's in excess of $3 trillion. It's what Joseph Stiglitz's book title is, The $3 Trillion War, because he's looked at all of the documented government costs and the on cost to come with veteran rehabilitation. That's not taking into account the impact on I mean, most of the impact of terrorism has been on Muslims across the Muslim world. But that's not the only kind of terrorism. We haven't mentioned the Democratic Congo of Republic of the Congo, which is, you know, a sadly named tragic country that is almost so such a tragic story that we don't even want to start talking about it. But that has seen immeasurably more suffering than most other countries that feature in our headlines, and it's been suffering at the hands of terrorist action. Some of it in the name of Christianity, some of it in the name of all sorts of things. So, yes, for many of us, 9/11 has resulted in vast expenditures. As Chandan said, we had in the Office of National Assessment, no counterterrorism experts. Now we've got sort of many, many people working on this issue. I think that's basically good. It's resulted in a lot of wasteful spending, but I wouldn't want to be too negative. I think we've, you know, basically, as Winston Churchill said of the Americans, you can rely upon them to do the right thing after first doing everything else. And that's probably true of all of us, and this is certainly true of what's happening in this area. But one of our blind spots is we only talk about international terrorism. We don't talk about what's happening to people domestically. And I think if we're to really get on top of undermining the power of this extremist narrative, we have to address questions of injustice, which is what fuels this narrative.
Zara Kimpton.
I have a question, but I just thought as you finished there, I would be interested if somebody would comment whether Martin Bryant's, what he did at Port Arthur, whether that's actually thought to be domestic terrorism. That's just a very extra question. I feel quite troubled by, I think it was more what Dr. Doyle said when she said that there's a crisis of democracy in Europe with populist policies. I was in Europe recently, and I have to tell you that I spoke to a lot of people who I would not describe as being radical people, or they were just friends in England. And a lot of people expressed a worry about what is happening there with the Muslim immigration. Now, these weren't people that were being they were actually just wanting to talk about the fact that there are some social problems. And I think that, for instance, it made me think, you talked about human rights here with people wearing burqas. Now, I would like to go to a Muslim country like Iran and not have to wear a burqa. Isn't that an equivalent sort of human rights situation? I mean, it seems to me that we get criticised in the West for not, for maybe questioning the fact that people dress differently. But if you go to a place like Iran or Saudi Arabia where a woman can't drive or has to cover her head, aren't there big human rights issues that are not quite treated in the same way as we are supposed to treat them here?
Thanks,
Sarah. Right, so Mitchell,
are we going
to say something first?
Just on the issue of Martin Bryant, if Greg, if you want to put in anything. I was just going to say very quickly with Bryant, the issue there with framing it as terrorism would be the absence of some form of public manifesto, some form of ideology, some form of rhetoric that he wanted to push. I'm not saying he doesn't have these things, but it hasn't really become publicly known in Australia. So without actually talking to the individual, without getting a better understanding of his process, I'd be inclined not to frame it in the terrorism category. I think one of the joys of the English language too is we have thousands upon thousands of words that we can use to describe nuances within different categories of things that happen, rather than just sticking this blanket sort of terrorism label on everything. I think it's important to understand the kind of causes and the motivations behind each individual.
Well,
if I can address your question about Muslim immigration. Yeah, I think you put your finger on a really important point, and this is a really difficult thing about this new form of extremism that is developing in Europe. People already said that way back in the 1980s about the French National Front. They are asking the right question, but they're giving the wrong answers, meaning that they are definitely problems associated with immigration, which is to a large extent immigration of people from Muslim countries. These questions are obviously linked, number one, to the fact that there has been an immigration which was an immigration of the good times, right, and which has produced a second generation, a third generation, which European states have not been very successful in integrating into their societies, and have therefore developed into a kind of subclass that has been marginalized. And many sociologists have drawn the analogy between the black Americans, Afro-Americans, and Muslims in certain European countries, and I'm particularly thinking of France. It's clear the parallels are there, you know, the urban ghettos, the marginalization, the high unemployment rates, the low educational profile. So this is not to say that there are not issues that exist with immigration in Europe and immigration of people who come from countries of Muslim culture. There are some, definitely, and this is obviously linked to the question of a withdrawal of the state, plus also maybe a failure of the state in the sense that patterns of migration were allowed, which were established in the economically successful years, you know, the 30s after the Second World War, they were allowed to persist. Plus also a lot of immigration linked to asylum seekers, which also has a strong Muslim component. So there are definitely problems associated with immigration in Europe. So the problem is how you then look at the source of those problems. Those problems mix socioeconomic factors that I've just alluded to, you know, low employment rates, poor education, urban segregation, which has different forms in France and in Britain, and the issue of cultural difference. The big factor, which I think, and that was something that was presented by a very prominent sociologist at the conference that I have been part of, is that in fact the problem of Muslims in Europe is they have lost their Muslim culture. Often they are in fact not well educated religiously, which then makes them vulnerable to the extremist ideology of jihadists who come and tell them this is what Islam is about. The second generation, and obviously in a country like France, but also in Germany, you suddenly see the third generation of Muslim migrants just don't really have a clue what Muslim culture is. They've not ever been in a Muslim country. They are considered as strangers if they go back to the country of their forebears. They are really just aliens in Muslim cultures and aliens in Europe. And this is creating a specific problem of alienation, which obviously the extreme right wing is pointing to, but then wants to attribute exclusively to the question of cultural / religious identity, and I think this is what is reductive. Now you raise another big point, which is a question, obviously, the whole debate around the hijab and the burqa. I think from my point of view, and of course I will not claim that I have all the answers, nor that I understand fully those issues, but there is, first of all, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, Burkina. Well, Saudi Arabia is not a democratic country, and we know that, right? And we know that Saudi Arabia has been, in fact, a great source of radicalization, precisely because of the lack of political democracy, the lack of rights in Saudi Arabia, the injustice. So in a sense, can we then sort of say, well, Saudi Arabia, you're forced to wear, to cover your head when you're a woman, and then why don't we do the same thing in Western countries? I mean, this is to forget that there is an essential difference between Western countries and Saudi Arabia. We claim to be democratic, and we have a commitment to human rights, which Saudi Arabia never has. Stated. Then there is another issue, which I think is a different one, and it's taken me a long time to work through this, because to tell you the truth, had you asked me that question about 4 years ago, I would have totally agreed with you, right? Because I as a woman, and I suppose I would also consider myself as a feminist, right? I'm deeply offended, right? Deeply offended by the Muslim dress code for women. I absolutely do not see why women should cover their hair, right? I do not see, you know, how there can be societies where women, the sight of a woman's face, a woman's hair, is so offensive, right, that she has to cover. So I am angry about those things as well, right? But then I approach it from the angles I told you, as we are a democratic country, we have a commitment to human rights, but I also approach it from the point of view of politics. Right? The art of politics is an art of managing situation, managing conflict of values, managing conflicts of interests. And what is happening in Europe is that this whole issue of the burqa has been blown out, right, into such proportion that I think it's being becoming totally counterproductive, because it's in fact alienating, right, even more so a population that is already, you know, feeling not accepted. And I think that to understand this, you need to put some figures on it, right? When the Danish government, because the Danish government also debated bringing in an anti-burqa law, right? So they spent weeks and weeks debating it, right? And then somebody said, oh, maybe we should hold a commission and find out, you know, what the problem is in Denmark. And so they sent out some public servants to investigate how many women in Denmark actually wore the burqa, which covers the face, or the Saudi Arabia niqab, which shows the eyes. They found 3 women. Right? In the case of France, France has just passed the so-called, it's not an anti-burqa law, it's you're not supposed to hide your face, right? So they had to make an exemption actually for Santa Claus beards, would you believe? And I am not joking, it is true, right? It is true, this is the degree of absurdity, right? And same thing, you know, they try, you know, they conducted an inquiry as to, it's a bit difficult because in France you're not supposed to actually ask questions about, you know, their religion, it's anti-constitutional to ask people about their religion, their ethnic identity, or whatever. But there are very, very reliable estimates that it only involves about 2,000 women in France. Now, if you look at the money that was wasted, the energy that was wasted in all those debates around those burqa, you have to ask the question, haven't Western societies lost the plot somewhat? You know? And is it really an effective way? Yes. There are some women, some of them are wearing the burqa in France because they come from cultures where women wear them, right? So we're talking about a process of acculturation, you know, a process of modernization. And then I think back to my grandmother, who never left the house without a hat and gloves, right? I remember when I was a little girl accompanying my mother going to Catholic church, and what, I'd be so surprised that she would rip out a scarf out of her bag and put it over her head, right? And look how much change happened, right, in a country like France where I was born. I think also I came to Austria in 1979, so long ago, to have seen a certain generation of Greek women migrants, right? And what also they looked like, right? And now I see, I teach young Greek women, right? And there's been so much change. Right. So I think that there is a question of political, you know, political strategy, political wisdom, and to we've got to defend those principles. So the issues, to, for example, of identity cards, driver's license, all the rest of it, it's terribly important to say, no, you cannot wear a burqa and you have to show your face and you have to have proper identity papers. But I think otherwise a bit of flexibility is needed, because the danger, as I say, is alienating. Right. And then you make the problem worse. So I share your views to a very large extent, but in other words, I suppose I have put a bit of water in my wine, as we say in French.
Interesting, Doctor, that you should mention Denmark, because I believe that the debate about immigration in Denmark has been very extended or extensive over recent times, and one of the things they did debate was in relation to the wearing of the burqa. But things do change. I was nearly arrested in Spain in 1962, to be precise, because I was wearing shorts. And men or boys weren't allowed to wear shorts in those days, and the Guardia Civil, remember those chaps in the flat hats, came up and he wanted to drag me away because I was wearing shorts. But I'm pleased to say you can now wear shorts in Spain. Who wants to ask the next question? Yeah, over here.
Paul Bill. Greg, Robert Fisk wrote an article in the Independent and said that since 9/11 nothing really has changed a great deal. It's still about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And that hasn't been mentioned tonight. So what extent is that unloading the terrorists?
Well, it's a good question. I thought of flagging it as I went through, but in lack of time, I thought we'd just slide on because it's not a central question. There is no doubt that if we have a just and lasting peace in the Arab-Israeli conflict, if there's a viable Palestinian state that has good relations with its neighbours, then that's one less item of rhetoric for the extremists to use, and it is something that they've used quite a lot. But you know, Al-Qaeda was at their business long before they cottoned onto that issue. The religious dimension in the Arab-Israeli conflict only really came to the fore after the collapse of the 2000 Camp David talks. Al-Qaeda hadn't mentioned it much before. It saw that this was one issue that across the Middle East people were sort of generally agreed upon, so it latched onto it. If it can be solved, it would be wonderful. I think we should put more effort into it. I don't argue with that. But it's not the silver bullet. In fact, there are no silver bullets out there, but that's certainly not one. The bigger issue, though, is injustice, and that's why this plays into that narrative. But it's injustice across a whole lot of fronts, and we've made a variety of mistakes in our counterterrorism responses that have shot ourselves in the foot when it comes to the question of injustice. The current circumstance is difficult, and it's tempting. It's always tempting with these frustrating situations to sort of just say that's the person at fault, so we'll blame Netanyahu or whatever, but it's not that simple.
Is there a question over this side? Right down the back, sir, isn't there?
I think that in a way, emphasised the part that we have played in keeping the existence of conflict terrorism alive after 10 years ago. But of course, we do have one instrument which you have mentioned, which Greg Barton did the thing of the made a mistake we made in going into Iraq, but we did, and I'm sure that's just exactly what Al-Qaeda wanted us to do, and we played into their hands on that. The problem is that George Bush, Tony Blair, John Howard are all too young to remember at first hand, as I do, the discussions which proceeded in involved in the formation of the United Nations in 1945. And we have there an instrument to which Arabia belongs, which provides for action by consensus, through the Security Council and its veto. And this is the kind of place where acculturation can be expressed and particular action might be avoided, which play into the hand of
Look, I think you're right, John. You're right in that Al-Qaeda, and this is generally true of modern terrorism, it was trying to provoke an angry response. It did something outrageous. We were outraged. We responded. It expected the West, led by America, to go into Afghanistan. I don't know that it expected Iraq, so we gave them a bonus there. It ended up damaging Al-Qaeda as well, because they also overplayed their hand in violence against Muslims. But with terrorism, we have to stop and ask ourselves, they're trying to provoke us. What response do they want us to give them, and what response should we give? I think we had to do something in Afghanistan, we should have done it better than we did. It's interesting your point that with Afghanistan there was broad international consensus. We lost that consensus not with Afghanistan but with Iraq. It's interesting also with the Arab Spring, which we haven't had time to discuss, that a key turning point there was the Arab League coming to a point of consensus and broad international community consensus, both in the region and globally, that I think was key there. And I think Obama quite wisely stayed his hand until he had to speak on regarding cutting ties with Mubarak. But yeah, you're right. It's these things have been unwell, need international consensus. There are mechanisms, and I don't doubt that the processes behind the decision to invade Iraq will be long studied as an example of how not to do these things.
Yeah, Jim.
Thanks, Jim Short. The title of the night has been terrific, World of Terrorism 10 years after 9/11. But to care to speculate where we're going to be in another 5 years?
Yeah, I think 5 years is relatively easy.
I was going to say 10, but I thought it was pretty far out.
15 gets harder, and 50 is almost impossible. I think in 5 years, we're still going to have a serious problem from Al-Qaeda-style, that narrative, that kind of terrorism, and from Al-Qaeda itself, and certainly its affiliates like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I think if you go 15 years out, there's some hope that Al-Qaeda is a greatly diminished organisation, but that narrative will still be a very live narrative. Sadly, if you go out sort of 15, 20 years, I think we have to accept the fact that there are going to be other people using that same kind of extremist logic. As Natalie says, they're in the same space. What Breivik was doing was not so different than the people that he was railing against. I mean, sort of notionally railing against this sort of created threat, which he then actualized himself. And I think that there will be other threats faced from that kind of, if you want, for lack of a better term, extreme right-wing behavior. We don't know what was in Timothy McVeigh's mind. He's not with us, so we can't really ask him anymore, which is great pity from that point of view. We have a better sense of Breivik's mind because he won't shut up and has written this long manifesto and wants attention. Breivik, of course, used assault weapons very effectively. You'd have to be a supreme optimist to say that'll never happen in America, given the access to assault weapons and given the prevalence of those ideas. Just in rounding that up, I think that report by the American Center for American Progress, Fear Inc., which you can find easily enough, is a very measured report. And what it shows is that the number of people who Breivik is quoting, and all the people in that report are quoted by Breivik, claim to speak to a sort of a majority of people who are concerned, but actually it's a very small number of people. The prime movers behind the outrage over the so-called 9/11 mosque, the Park 51 project, was this group of characters, half a dozen people really. But I think it's that sort of idea that we're going to have to contend with in future, and I think that we haven't seen the last of lone wolf people like Timothy McVeigh or Anders Breivik. And I think it's safe to say, and I hope all of you in the room live a very long time, but for all of our lifetimes, we will be dealing with this threat. We just have to not overreact. It's sort of a long marathon effort, and we're prone to sort of swing one way or the other and overreact and say it's an existential threat. It's not, or overreact and say there's no problem. It's gone away. If we just hold hands, it'll be not a problem. Neither of those things are true.
Thank you, Michael. Bill Pickford, of the Institute. One of the things that concerns me is watching the debate in our own parliament in Canberra, and particularly where the issue of Islamists, most of whom want to live quietly and live a form of their faith in this country without trouble, and we're concerned about the extremists. But the minute any responsible debate is raised in the House, there's immediate reaction of racist screams across the floor. That is so utterly gutless and dishonest, because it's a discussion for the health of Islam in this country, for the health of Australia, that needs to be had. And that sort of call denies any responsible or open discussion. But I think for everybody's sake in this, we need to face the fact that Islam can, because of the nature of its faith, present a serious problem, but we have to discuss it and handle it. So the people who follow that faith know where they are, and we know where we are. Until that happens, there are no boundaries, there's no sense of discussion, there's just hyperbole and slander hurled across the debate, and that gets no one anywhere.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'll be like Tony Jones. I'll take that as a comment. There's a question down here.
Yes, thank you, Glenn James. Leading on from what Dr. Natalie Dole said earlier about the cultural impact of or the socioeconomic relationship, like the injustices that we see that is linked to extremism and terrorism, why is it that counter-terrorism measures are largely seen as a physical or a security response rather than addressing these issues, and will we ever see this tactically in work?
Yeah, look, that's a good question. I mentioned President Obama's speech the other week. He was referring to countering violent extremism. It's a fairly new thing for most American police forces. Chris Heffelfinger, if he had been here tonight, I'm sure would have retold his account that as he was training FBI agents, helping them understand more about Islam, he discovered that most of them had never had any contact with Muslim communities. That the first time most of them had a conversation with an imam, it was when there was an arrest warrant, or a search warrant more likely, I guess. In other words, when there was a problem. I don't say that things in Australia are perfect, but they're a long way ahead of that. And for all of its problems, the UK is generally sort of very cognizant of these issues, and that's the path we've been following. My point is simply that's what we have to do more of. It's not Islam or Muslims that's a problem. It's a very small number of people who, in the name of Islam, you might recall the third commandment, the Ten Commandments, told us not to use the name of the Lord your God in vain. Well, people of all faiths are often speaking in God's name, and it's people who claim to have a particular insight into what Islam means, which is at variance with the historical narrative. And so it's not hard to counter. You have a well-educated Islamic teacher, an alim, and they will explain this is mistaken on so many levels. But that's what we need to be doing. So there's been a lot of work done in Victoria working with the imams in mosques, and they've been very receptive. There's a lot of good news that doesn't make it into our papers because, you know the old adage, I mean, good news doesn't sell in the same way. It's not so spectacular. But I'd be the first to acknowledge mistakes made, but I think we should also acknowledge that in Australia we're actually leading the world in getting some of these things right, and it comes to this cooperation with communities and encountering these problems before they emerge.
Isn't it being done also in Saudi and
it is. I mean, Saudi Arabia is its own case. The Saudi leadership recognises that they've got a serious problem, but it's like the adage about riding the tiger. They don't quite know how to dismount without being eaten. There's no easy way to solve the problem that they're in. And so they are working, and I think ideally things will swing around and they will sort of begin to get on top of the problem. We need to sort of be prepared to accept that they are well intended, but there's a lot of problems that have come out of the state doctrine that for a long time the Saudi state has sponsored. Indonesia is more complex. I think the Indonesian police, many of them intuitively recognise what needs to be done. Many of them have launched into ad hoc private initiatives to rehabilitate convicted terrorists. The trouble is that they're not receiving much funding support. There's not much coordination. And whilst I'm prepared to certainly praise them for some of the things they've done that's been very good, they really are lagging when it comes to community policing and engaging with communities. The communities don't trust the Indonesian police for reasons that are not entirely their own fault, to do with the heritage of the Suharto era. And so the challenge for them is dealing with radicalisation. And that means engaging with communities and, as this acronym says, countering violent extremism. And they're doing a little bit of it. They're going to have to do a whole lot more. And I just hope the political will is there to do it.
Yes.
You seem to characterise Breivik as being a kind of lone wolf, isolated incident thing. Given that the conditions exist currently in Europe for great social ferment on the basis that we have reasonably weak government and the conditions for great social unrest, the development of the kinds of ideas that he talks about, it seems to me is that the conditions are somewhat ripe for this to be emulated. Would you care to comment?
I think you're right. I think that Breivik fits into that category of lone wolf. But the conditions are right. When you have countries such as Spain with 20% unemployment, when you have now all the, you know, because I finally reached the euro crisis. When you have all the dominoes falling, first it hit Portugal and Spain, and now it's starting to threaten Italy, and next it will be France in line. And the metaphor being not the dominoes, the best metaphor not being the dominoes, but mountain climbers connected by rope, you know, and when one member of the team falls off the cliff, then the rest can pull him up. But when it's two, it becomes a bit harder, and when it becomes three, it becomes virtually impossible. And this is what's happening in the Eurozone. So all the countries are, in a sense, being threatened. And the problem is becoming so big, you know, that Portugal, they could manage it, but Italy, they can't. So Europe is being threatened by a major social crisis because the response, wisely or unwisely, and I'm not an economist, and I did vow to myself that I would not go into the euro crisis, that wisely or unwisely, the austerity measures that have been adopted to try and cope with the crisis, which is basically to assuage the financial markets, to reassure them and to stop what are essentially speculative attacks against the euro. It's creating circumstances in which the societies are going to be very strained in proportions which, of course, I bring to mind the parallel with the 30s. Right. With the 30s, and then obviously, you know, what everybody is discussing is that can the same thing happen? This is why the parallels, you know, I mean, I didn't come up with those parallels, but that's why those parallels are troubling, the parallels between the anti-Semitism, right, which obviously surfaced at the end of the 19th century, but then gathered speed, and in the 30s we know what it produced. Though I do think that obviously a lot has changed since the 1930s. So what is, I think, is more worrying is the fact that this extremism has found its way into mainstream politics. When you see a member of the German Socialist Party, Thilo Sarrazin, making declarations that Islam is a threat for Europe, well, when other categories and not just Muslims start being targeted, because you also see in Europe greater hostility against the Romas, the Roman population, then you do worry. But obviously, I don't think it will. I don't think we're talking about the proportions, right, which characterize the 30s. Right? But we are certainly seeing the appearance of a kind of populist is not a good label, but you know, for the sake of the argument, populist democracy, right, in which those Islamophobic themes, or broadly xenophobic, to incorporate the Romas, are being used to try and divert attention from the disastrous situation in which Europe finds itself as a result of the crisis of the euro and more broadly the crisis of sovereign debt. So I don't know if I've answered your question totally.
Thank you. Has anybody got a burning question that they need to get off their chest? Because I notice a few people sort of looking at anxiously at the door. Yeah, we'll take this one as the last.
Yeah, I've got a question for Shannon.
Good man.
You're not doing enough. With the London bombings, as Dr. Dorr mentioned, the alienation of second-generation migrants was seen as an issue. How far is that an issue in Australia now and certainly into the future?
I think sort of within that network I put up, again, we're talking a very, very small proportion of people that actually have a propensity to enact some form of violence. A colleague last week mentioned the term radicalization is everything left of boom. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to have these kind of views. We accept in Australia, particularly, that social conditions aren't perfect. They're better than in some places in Europe. They're, to an extent, better than America. But I think if we can develop strategies, whether they be done through law enforcement, through communities, to help not only integrate these people into society, but I don't want to use the word to make them belong. They come with their own identities, their own feelings. We don't want them to necessarily have to become westernized, but to simply feel comfortable enough in society that they don't feel the need to attack that in which they live. We actually have a bit of a phenomenon in Australia where it's only a couple of certain demographics and certain populations where you have problems. We've seen a lot of issues with second generation Lebanese, which doesn't tend to exist in Europe. It doesn't tend to exist in America, with not only second generation Lebanese becoming involved with terrorism here, but also going back to Lebanon and being involved with Islamist groups there.
So by no means has Australia got it perfect. We definitely have issues there, but I think we have a lot of cause for optimism that this isn't a widespread problem, and that by and large integration into society by second generation members of particularly Muslim societies, but from everywhere, is handled quite well. Yeah, I hope that answers your question in a roundabout way.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, would you join with me in thanking our three speakers very sincerely for their time and effort that they've put in to being here to tonight, but certainly for informing us, and we're certainly better informed, and I hope some of us are indeed wiser than when we came. So would you please join with me in thanking the very